we have you sitting at round tables because our format for today will be a plenary presentation followed by a period of time of discussion at your table with your table friends, followed by a more plenary session of Q&A. And that will be moderated by Phil Kinnison, who also has the privilege today of introducing to us our first plenary speaker. Phil should be no stranger to any of you. He is was for many years the chair of the board of the Ecclesia Project, but even was more widely known within the project for his incredible work with the Congregational Formation Initiative, which he continues to spearhead. And it's without a doubt our most ambitious initiative of the Ecclesia Project. So Phil, will you come and introduce Deb?
I have been given the honor of introducing a dear friend who will deliver our first address this year. I first had the privilege of meeting and getting to know Deborah Dean Murphy well over 20 years ago when she was studying at Duke Divinity School. Deborah's considerable gifts and passions impressed me then, and my respect and gratitude for her have only grown deeper over these decades. For me, Deborah beautifully blurs the boundaries between our largely unhelpful categories of pastor and scholar. Although she has devoted many years of her life to the careful study of Christian theology, having earned degrees from Duke and Drew University, Deborah's theology has always been in service of the church. Whether penning a very fine book on the need to rethink our models of Christian education, or serving for many years herself as director of Christian education at a large suburban United Methodist church near Raleigh, North Carolina, or blogging on any number of contemporary issues, Deborah always has a masterful way of bringing sound Christian theology to bear on the stuff of our everyday lives. For many years, she's also been a faithful contributor to the work of the Ecclesia Project. In addition to being one of our most faithful and insightful bloggers, she's also been intimately involved in the development and implementation of the Congregational Formation Initiative. Deborah not only led one of our six pilot congregations through CFI, but she also helped write and edit much of the curriculum. In short, Deborah is one of those dear friends that many of us can't imagine ourselves without. And as an aside, I might mention that I suspect that it's for these and many other good reasons that the EP board just this morning elected Deborah to be our next board chair. Last fall, Deborah accepted an invitation to return to her alma mater, West Virginia Wesleyan, where she now teaches religion and Christian education, along with her husband, Jim, a United Methodist pastor, who also joins us this week. They're the parents of two grown sons, Drew and Patrick. I honestly can't think of a more appropriate person to offer our opening plenary address on this year's theme. Deborah cares deeply about the church, has devoted herself tirelessly over the years to the church's work of discipleship, and cares immensely about words and the power of words. So please join me in welcoming Deborah for her opening address entitled, "And God Said, Creation, Word Care, and Care of the World."
Thank you, Phil. And let me add my thanks to Sharon and Grace Fellowship Community Church for the worship this morning. It seems fitting to me that we always begin these sessions with worship where the word is always grounded. So again, thank you for setting the stage for these days together. In the beginning was the Word. Perhaps it's not too much of an overstatement to say that the church exists to continually speak the truth of these words. The church, we might say, is a linguistic community that seeks to bear truthful witness to the Logos, which was in the beginning with God, and which was God. And if, as Wendell Berry has said, language is communal and its purpose is to tell the truth, then the church shares not only a way of speaking, but as we know, a whole way of living that points to the Word made flesh as the source and bearer of all truth. More specifically, we could say that the church is a linguistic body in the sense that it is a community other than Israel, that hears Israel's story as its own by way of the story of Jesus. Talk of the divine Logos always takes us back to Torah, to the story of a called out people and their covenant keeping God. But Torah also always sends us back to the apostolic witness, since in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth can only be understood in light of in the beginning was the Word. And so I'll begin by briefly tracing this circular motion from creation to Christ and back again, how it is that the word spoken at creation's beginning is history's saving logos that rescues and redeems, blesses and heals. In Easter's garden, on the first day of the week, the burden of Eden's garden is rolled away. Through the logos of God, creation and salvation are of a piece. Secondly, we'll take up the practice of word care as radical discipleship, specifically addressing creation's call to be good stewards of the gift of language. We'll look at some familiar ways that our talk is cheap, how it is that we depreciate the value of words and diminish the power of our witness by paying insufficient attention to language and its uses. I'll also suggest that the idea of God at play in creating the cosmos offers rich associations for how we might consider theological and liturgical wordplay as a form of word care. A brief look at Trinitarian theology will help us to see that Christians can risk playing with language because we are a people who live by God's extravagant, abundant, playful grace. Thirdly, as the visible word in the world, Christ's body speaks with words and actions, the priestly writer's refrain regarding the created order. God saw that it was good. So we'll ask how it is that caring for words is a form of caring for the world. That is, how the subject of all our theological reflection is not words in the end, but the world God loves. My reflections are wide-ranging and only begin to gesture toward answers to the question of how God's speech and ours offer a witness against language that distorts and diminishes. But I hope what I have to say contributes something of value to our conversation over these 3 days, an image maybe, an insight, as together we ponder the relationship between language and radical Christian discipleship. I guess I should say that there's an outline in your packets, if that might be helpful for you to follow along. That is there.
On the left side.
On the left side. And so the first section, creation, the beginning, the end, and the anxious middle. The problem with creation, I want to suggest, is that it comes at the beginning. The Bible opens with the familiar majestic hymn of Genesis 1. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, each stanza recounts with increasing attention to detail what divine speech has brought forth. Light, sky and seas and earth, plants and fruit trees, sun and moon, sea creatures, birds, and land animals, and finally, humankind, made in the image of this God who speaks a world into being. Another creation story, as you know, comes immediately on the heels of this one, a much earlier story, it turns out, an earthier one in which Yahweh, not the transcendent deity of the priestly hymn, is down and dirty in the mud, fashioning Adam, the red earth man, and breathing life into his nostrils. There's a beautiful garden. Birds and animals appear. And after a bit of divinely elected surgery, a woman is created and brought to the man. That there are two creation stories has been a source of confusion, denial, and disappointment throughout the centuries. Unsuspecting undergraduates and many first-year seminarians are regularly ambushed by this revelation in Genesis that two very different stories of origin sit side by side in the sacred text. Biblical critics and historians tell us why this is so, and yet, as commentator Rusty Reno suggests, and as Genesis itself seems to insist, these two accounts can be seen as complementary portrayals of the same stage-setting divine act. God spoke, God acted, creation happened. Seems straightforward enough, even when we allow that the two stories, the liturgical poem of Genesis 1 and the older Yahwistic tradition of chapter 2, are not geological accounts of Earth's origins, but ways of seeing the world with God and in relation to God. But even so, it's hard to shake the idea of creation as something that God did once, way back then. Creationists, evolutionists, advocates of intelligent design, all assume that the Christian doctrine of creation is a theory about how everything got started a long time ago. And so do most people in the pews. But what the church confesses is that God speaks, God acts, present tense. Creation, as Aquinas insisted, is the ongoing action of God that establishes a relationship between God and what is not God. God speaks and calls into being a world that is other than God. God is not bound to this created world, but the world is bound utterly to God. Rowan Williams helps us to grasp not only the power, but the poignant beauty of this truth when he says that it should be a rather exhilarating thought that the moment of creation is now. That if, by some unthinkable accident, God's attention slipped, we wouldn't be here. It means that within every circumstance, every object, every person, God's action is going on, a sort of white heat at the center of everything. It means that each of us is already in a relationship with God before we ever even thought about it. It means that every object or person we encounter is in a relationship with God before they're in a relationship of any kind with us. And if that doesn't make us approach the world and other people with reverence and amazement, says Williams, I don't know what will. In the beginning, out of freedom, out of nothing, God created the heavens and the earth. But we don't really start at the beginning. The truth of God's creating work meets us in the anxious middle between the beginning and the end. And it is the end, we believe, which explains the beginning. The church, as Bonhoeffer puts it, bears witness to the end of all things. It lives from the end. It thinks from the end. It acts from the end. It proclaims its message from the end. It is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth that make known the God of creation's beginnings, that reveal God's purposes for the whole created order. All creation breathes with the life of the Logos, apart from whom there is no life. As John's prologue has it, what has come into being in him was life. Again, this seems straightforward enough, but we're actually rather used to thinking of creation and salvation as if they didn't have all that much to do with each other, as if they were discrete plot points on a storyline that goes something like this. A long time ago, God created the world. Soon enough, sin entered the picture and a fall occurred, necessitating a rescue. God sent Jesus to do the saving work on the cross, and now, because of his resurrection, we have the hope someday of heaven. But if creation and salvation are different sorts of events in this way, albeit existing along a continuum, then it is not at all evident that there is a real relationship between the Creator and the Savior. Or as James Allison puts it, it's not clear what God has to do with Jesus. We see from the perspective of the end, and only from Christ can we know what the beginning is. Creation is not something that God did once, but what God is doing now in and through Jesus. Creation is being brought to completion through the life, death, and resurrection of a first century Palestinian Jew who was tortured and executed by the imperial powers. The free gift that Jesus makes of his death on the cross is the same divine graciousness that brings the world into existence from nothing. It is not as though creation were a different act, Allison reminds us, something which happened alongside the salvation worked by Jesus, but rather that the salvation which Jesus was working was, at the same time, the fulfillment of creation. Scripture shows us this. John the Evangelist sets the resurrection story in a garden, grounding Easter's hope in, well, the ground. The tree of life, as Vigen Guroian observes, still stands in a garden. The hope of resurrection is that the material creation in all its fullness participates, now partially, then perfectly, in newness of life, in communion with the source of all that is. Heaven and earth are joined through the mystery of Jesus rising from the dead in the shalom of God. Because the church reads Genesis with the help of John's gospel, we can say, as Bonhoeffer does, that only in the word of creation do we know the Creator. In the word in the middle do we have the beginning. And the word that was in the beginning with God and that was God is, we believe, God's self-statement in the flesh and texture of history. What God has spoken to us is not some particular message behind which he may have a rather different message up his sleeve. God's word is God's self, the Logos who dwelt among us full of grace and truth. I mentioned a moment ago that the church exists as a linguistic community, an idea that Barry will take up in greater detail on Thursday. Linguistic community is not a particularly elegant description of the church, but it is an apt one. It reminds us that Christ's body lives by words, by the word itself. That in hearing Israel's story as its own by way of the story of Jesus, the church uses words in particular ways. Each of the church's doctrines, for instance, the Trinity, say, or our topic at hand, creation, function something like a grammar for guiding and ordering our speech. Doctrines help to provide what Nicholas Lash calls a set of protocols against idolatry. They tell us what we can't say as much as what we can. Steve will take us more deeply into this in his treatment of language and what it means to say that God has spoken in the Son. And Barry, again on Thursday, will use John's apocalypse to flesh out some particulars of the church as a community of word care. But I hope it's already clear that the one-word categories the three of us were assigned to help guide our shared conversations on language and discipleship, creation, Christ, church, are necessarily intertwined and always mutually informing. Each presumes the others, and their order is always muddled. But for now, we come to these questions. How does the church's understanding of creation enjoin us to be good stewards of language? How do we as creatures exercise our responsibility to care properly for the words we've been given to speak? As has already been mentioned, Sharon said to the EP board last year while we were making plans for this gathering, words are all we've got, and so it matters how we care for them. And so the second part, stewards of the gift of language. Who would have thought that measuring our words would come to mean observing the 140-character limit of a Twitter post or crafting the perfect, clever, yet concise Facebook status update? A friend recently confessed that she often finds herself parsing her experience into Facebook status updates in an internal commentary in her head. Her honesty points to how easily all of us are caught up in forums and media in which a good deal of attention is paid to words, but very little to language, to the shared forms of life that make language more than just a mode of communication. If you're a regular on Facebook, maybe you've been the recipient or even the perpetrator of a status update that failed to communicate, a cryptic message about something personal in your life, or an obscure song lyric posted for no apparent reason. I've noticed that college students seem to favor the obscure song lyric option in what I take to be a perverse attempt to confound their elders. Such miscommunication is more, though, than sloppy speech or willful confusion. It falls under the category, I suggest, of what Wendell Berry calls the illegitimate use of the powers of language. Language that becomes too subjective, says Berry, that is too cut off from a common world, will impose rather than elicit its desired response. Genuine communication, real understanding, will not take place. Now, if you are not a part of the world of Facebook, first of all, you are much admired for your resistance. And secondly, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about, which is pretty much the point. It isn't just new social media that present a challenge to the stewardship of language and the practice of word care, obviously. The church has long been in the grip of the language of the market, of investment and growth, of management, results, and advertising strategies. We're also captive to the language of consumerism, which makes salvation a commodity obtained through a personal decision and colludes with the discourse of entertainment to present us with an array of choices when it comes to worship styles and mission opportunities. Much of the church's worship speaks the language of commercial pop music, with its emphasis on facile lyrics and simplistic melodies. Praise music, it's called. You might have heard of it. One example is a popular chorus called, "Our God is an Awesome God." I often think about this song alongside "A Mighty Fortress is Our God," which is not only a praise song of sorts, but is also a tour de force in Christian theology and doctrine. Salvation, creation, incarnation, Christology, death, evil, eschatology. It's all there in Luther's rousing anthem, crafted into a narrative with tropes and images that resonate deeply with the story world of Scripture. "Our God is an Awesome God" is skimpy and artless by comparison and lacking in textual and musical nuance. Moreover, songs like "Awesome God" do not mine the deep reservoirs of the church's theological and biblical heritage. And because interiority is their hook, there is no traditioned speech they draw on or are indebted to. They impose rather than elicit their desired response. Many churches live in the language world of computer technology, where Microsoft's PowerPoint does the talking on Sunday morning. Just as a typical PowerPoint presentation in an IBM boardroom too readily elevates format over content, chart junk, as one critic has called it, PowerPoint in worship reproduces the same stacking of text, the relentless sequentiality that divorces content from context. When the text of a hymn, or more likely a praise song, is projected onto the big screen, it can only be experienced as fragmentary and incoherent. Small groupings of words cut off from the narrative whole and no musical notation at all. The textual and theological arc of a great hymn cannot be communicated when only a few lines of text can be accommodated on each of the 30, 40, 50-something frames it may take to display the entire hymn. Worse, perhaps, is the morning sermon brought to you by PowerPoint. Richard Lisher has noted that the projected outline of the sermon gives the impression of a reasoned flow of information, but the conversational, dialectical aspect of the sermon is eliminated. We are left with a list. And this returns us, I suggest, to an observation made a moment ago. Our cultural fixation on words, but our lack of attention to language and its shared forms of life. Like the boxed script under a TV talking head, words on a big screen in church are flat, depthless, isolated from context and practice. But the words we speak in worship and also in preaching are often so dense and so odd that they make no sense apart from the church's strange language and its attendant practices and gestures. This is my body is simple enough English, but it is a phrase that both acknowledges a mystery beyond human language and requires the peculiar linguistic community of the church for its intelligibility. There's an unspoken assumption undergirding this practice of borrowing from language worlds for the church's worship and ministry, from corporate culture, commercial pop music, computer technology, and so on. The unspoken assumption is this, that they are value neutral, mere tools that can be taken up and used without affecting the job at hand or its outcome. But of course, no medium or discourse is value neutral. Theology done on a blog is not the same as theology done in a book or in a classroom. I think that it's possible to do theology well on a blog, and there's going to be a workshop tomorrow talking about that. But form always shapes content, and we are unavoidably affected by the discourses and media we engage. That's part of their power and their point. To be stewards of the strange language of the gospel, though, is not to try and protect it from outside influences, as if that were even possible. We communicate our story through speech that is always culturally conditioned, but we also practice discernment in the ways we tell the story, alert to temptations that would minimize or domesticate or otherwise miscommunicate the unsettling grace that comes to us in the Logos of God. Temptations that would make God nice, say, or religious, or one of us. The language of our call to worship earlier this afternoon struck me as an example of this kind of stewardship of language, this kind of recognition of the awesome God we worship. I'm also reminded of Annie Dillard's well-known observation about worship. I often think about the set pieces of liturgy, she says, as certain words which people have successfully addressed to God without their getting killed. We are stewards of a strange language indeed. We're used to describing the creation of the world as divine work. After all, God took a rest on the seventh day. We extrapolate from this to fashion an understanding of and a rationale for our own rhythms of work and rest. Moreover, we often associate creativity with work. There's a reason that a great musical composition is sometimes called an opus, from the Latin for work. More often than not, it is a product of intense labor, rigorous and exacting for mind and body. But there's also a sense that creativity is a form of play, and that God's own creative work is playful. Artists of all kinds are often thought to possess playful dispositions, something to admire, but something also to worry about a little. When will the poet, painter, sculptor, singer, writer get a real job? Of course, Christians historically have been suspicious of play. It's the Protestant work ethic, after all. For Augustine, you may remember, conversion to Christianity meant conversion from a life of play. But I suspect that Augustine rejected not the kind of playfulness under consideration here, but rather the enjoyment of the wrong things. When theologians talk about the creation of the world, they often describe it in terms of an overflow of Trinitarian love. God's very being, that which constitutes God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is communion, love in relationship. As John Zizioulas has argued, love is not an emanation or a property of the substance of God, but is constitutive of God's substance. It is that which makes God what he is, the one God. This love, the supreme ontological predicate, as Zizioulas puts it, overspills its bounds, we might say, such that the act of creation is the outflowing of the triune God's inexhaustible love. The love of the Holy Trinity cannot be contained, and the cosmos is born. Central to the Christian doctrine of creation is the idea that for God, there is no compulsion to create. God's love is already complete within the mutual self-giving of the persons of the Trinity. God lacks nothing. God needs nothing. And it's this reality which makes creation something of a playful enterprise. This overflow of divine love that brings the world into being is sheer gratuity, a gift that flows outward from the inner life of God. It is given freely, generously, and maybe we could say playfully. To risk a crude anthropomorphism here, it's as if God flung the stars into the vast heavens, a gesture of pure whimsy and joy. The second creation story in Genesis is suggestive of a God who wants to play with what God has created. When the psalmist says to and of God, "You make the clouds your chariot, you ride on the wings of the wind," we understand that the poetry is metaphorical, but it just sounds fun. G.K. Chesterton famously imagined the act of creation as God at play. Pondering a field of daisies, Chesterton envisioned God having created one daisy, delighting in it, and saying to himself, "Do it again, do it again." When we think of play in the human realm, we often misidentify it as aimless frivolity. There may be occasions when aimless frivolity is called for. I think it's on the schedule tonight from 7:45 to 9 o'clock, something like that. But that's not exactly what we're after here. Consider the philosophy of Maria Montessori, who turned the categories of work and play inside out with her studied observation that children at play are doing the work they've been given to do, the methodical, purposeful, deep work of establishing patterns in the body and mind that will serve as templates for all future learning, and that uptight, workaholic adults might have something to learn from this. Or consider the phenomenon of improvisation in jazz, theater, or dance. There's a playfulness to the practice, an openness and generosity to one's partner or partners that glimpses, if only briefly, the playfulness of divine self-giving. It's not haphazard, but it is joyful. Musician and writer Stephen Nachmanovich suggests that the improvisation that occurs in art is the same creativity, what he calls free play, that can happen in the most ordinary of activities. Play is rooted in creatureliness, physicality. From a biblical point of view, it is the sheer delight in the goodness of being alive, of being a beloved creature of a generous God, fearfully and wonderfully made. It comes from learning to live thankful lives. It is freedom from the over-earnestness that stifles spontaneity and joy. It requires the habits of friendship, we can't really play alone, that allow us to receive the gift of another in our lives for no calculated end other than that of delighting in their physical presence. And perhaps play is also a kind of training in virtue, since playfulness is a quality we often recognize in people who practice generosity, patience, gentleness, peaceableness. What might all of this have to do with wordplay? In her recent book, Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies, Marilyn Chandler McIntyre suggests that play comes from loving life, and play with words comes from loving language. And we love language, I would suggest, when we are at home in it, when we have enough familiarity and facility to play with it and to be delighted and surprised by what such play might produce. McIntyre notes that the 16th century French writer Montaigne is credited with coining the term essay for the brief thought pieces he wrote. His writing, says McIntyre, has the delightful exuberance of someone who went through his life saying, in effect, like E.M. Forster, "How can I tell what I think till I see what I say?" Stanley Hauerwas has explored this idea in his writing, most recently in his memoir, Hannah's Child, reminding us that even theological writing, maybe especially theological writing, is an exercise in being surprised and changed by playing with words. But to play with words within the traditions of theology and liturgy is not to strive for cleverness or innovation. The theologian or liturgist, as Stanley has also taught us, is not charged with the task of originality, but with that of fidelity to a living tradition that has some parameters, to a language with some rules of speech. There are things we know we can't say, like, for instance, "That majestic mountain over there is God." But such limits are not limitations. Rather, they are, as Wendell Berry observes, inducements to formal elaboration and elegance, to fullness of relationship and meaning. That is, such limits make art and beauty possible. The received wisdom of the Christian tradition is an enclosure of sorts, but it's still a big room to play in. I think of Marilyn Robinson's marvelous novel, Gilead, as an example of the kind of rich play with language that makes art out of so little raw material and elegance out of textbook orthodoxy. Who knew Calvinism could be so beautiful? The setting of Gilead couldn't be more prosaic, a dusty town in Iowa in the 1950s, but Robinson is a skilled player with words and a more than competent theologian. In a narrative of minimal action, she brings new life to old words and ideas, taking your breath away with startling insights on topics like baptism, blessing, and the work of human hands. Robinson shows us that to be stewards of the gift of language is to live in grace. There's a particular passage in Gilead that plays with the idea that at the heart of the Christian life is a kind of divine playfulness. If you've read the book, I'm sure you'll recall it. Reverend Ames, the novel's narrator protagonist, says this: "Calvin says somewhere that each of us is an actor on a stage and God is the audience. That metaphor has always interested me because it makes us artists of our behavior, and the reaction of God to us might be thought of as aesthetic rather than morally judgmental in the ordinary sense. How well do we understand our role? With how much assurance do we perform it? I suppose Calvin's God was a Frenchman, just as mine is a Middle Westerner of New England extraction. Well, we all bring such light to bear on these matters as we can. I do like Calvin's image, though, because it suggests how God might actually enjoy us. I believe we think about that far too little." The genius of Marilyn Robinson aside, theological wordplay involves risk, and as McIntyre puts it, consent to the possibility of failure. It also requires trust. It is to trust in the truth that we are saved, loved, and perfectly safe, and so we are free to play around a little. In sermons, prayers, poems, blogs, even scholarly writing, we can loosen up a little and approach the holy work of bearing witness with our words as the serious play it is. It seems we must do this if we are going to reckon honestly with the church's failures, its capitulation to the powers, its inability to speak its own language fluently and persuasively. In as playful a poem as I know of, Wendell Berry gives us the needed word of encouragement: laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. And now the third part, word care and the care of the world. When the church attempts to speak the truth of God with words and with our lives, we are not talking to ourselves. In one way, of course, God is the proper audience for much of our speech, the words and work of liturgy, our prayers, both corporate and personal. In these speech acts, we respond to the Creator with the full range of feelings and dispositions that constitute our creatureliness. But as a linguistic community, the Church also communicates to the wider world. We may do this well or poorly, but we're always saying something. We've already visited some of the ways that the Church risks miscommunication by its uncritical adoption of other modes of discourse. This is an enduring challenge. The gospel is always spoken in particular times and places with all of the cultural and linguistic conventions that may obtain. Discerning what is faithful speech and practice and what is not isn't always easy. But in the anxious middle where the word always meets us, we are reminded that the peculiar language of the gospel can only be recognized by participating in it. This insight comes from Herbert McCabe, a playful theologian, if ever there was one, who points out that if you look from the outside at the new mode of communication that Jesus provides, it does not even look like a possible blueprint. It looks merely destructive. This, of course, is why Jesus was killed by the powers of his day. The openness of love, McCabe says, becomes the vulnerability of the victim. If you love enough, you will, in the long run, be killed. And because Jesus achieved his mission through failure, he is relevant not as past, but as future, as God's desired end that all creation be fulfilled through him. So the Church makes the presence of Christ articulate as a language, as an interpretation of the world. The resurrection, says McCabe, meant not just that a church was founded, it meant that the world was different. The Church exists to articulate this difference, to show the world to itself. There are many ways to talk about what that might mean, and McCabe goes on to suggest convincingly that it is the sacramental life of the Church that most fully reveals and realizes the revolutionary future of the world. But in my remaining moments, I want to return to our discussion of creation to briefly sketch out another possibility of what it might mean for the Church to show the world to itself. First, I take this so-called showing to be not an act of opposition or confrontation, but one of hospitality. In articulating the presence of Christ and practicing word care in its worship and witness, the Church loves and cares for the world. One of the foundational truths that the creation stories in Genesis reveal is that to be human is to live within limits. God is limitless, but we are not. We are not God. The fall that occurs in the garden in Genesis chapter 3 names the overreaching of our creaturely limits, our attempts to be godlike, and thus our sin lies in failing to claim and live into our creaturehood. Salvation consists, we might say, in our becoming fully human through the word that took on our human flesh. As I noted a moment ago in drawing on Wendell Berry, limits are not limitations. But this is a truism that does not square with the project that is modernity in a place like North America. Economists might talk about limitless growth or limitless wealth, but limitlessness is not an exclusively economic term. Rooted in one of modernity's guiding principles, the maximization of personal freedom, limitlessness is a defining quality of our being human. And under this principle, all are entitled to pursue without limit whatever they conceive as desirable. A license, Berry says, that classifies the most exalted Christian capitalist with the lowliest pornographer. In recent months, we have witnessed in vivid, chilling detail what belief in the doctrine of limitlessness has wrought. Credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations, those mysterious financial instruments invented out of thin air for the purpose of generating limitless wealth for corporate executives and shareholders. A busted oil well gushing millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico because of the demand for cheap, limitless energy. And calling the BP disaster a leak or a spill is one of the many examples in our public discourse of how words are, without much protest, evacuated of their commonly held meanings, sacrificing truth for the sake of spin. Words about the BP catastrophe, explanations, defenses, diatribes, rants, have spewed forth as profusely as the uncontained oil itself. Political speeches have pandered to constituencies who want either more rigorous development of renewable energy resources or a return, sooner rather than later, to drilling for oil here, there, and everywhere. But neither the right nor the left seems much interested in addressing the root problem: our need to be healed from the disease of limitlessness. How does the church show the world to itself in such a time as this? First, we must acknowledge, contrary to what I said a moment ago, that we are talking as much to ourselves as to others on this one. It's probably safe to assume that none of us in this room have been involved in naked short selling or any of the other corruptions born of Wall Street's limitless greed. But when it comes to the catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico, all of us are, as our friend Brian Volk wrote recently, accessories to the crime. And it's not just the cars we drive. It's the petroleum that drives the American food system, and the petroleum necessary to produce the cheap plastic we love, like the ubiquitous petroleum-based plastic water bottles we can't seem to live without. Yet even when we're not quite sure how to extricate ourselves from our complicity in the destruction of seas and soil, riverbeds and mountaintops, we exist as members of one another and of Christ's body, the church, to make the presence of Christ articulate as an interpretation of the world, to express in words and deeds the difference that the God of creation and resurrection makes. The Logos became particular flesh in a particular place, embodying the limitlessness of divine mercy and grace in the finitude of one earthly life. When Jesus says in John's Gospel, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly," we hear these words as a call to counter the economics of extinction with ways of living that speak to the fullness of life for all that God has spoken into being. The limits of a finite planet, there is not an inexhaustible supply of oil in the ground, are not hindrances to abundant living, contrary to consumer capitalism's working hypothesis. Rather, they are the conditions under which fullness of life for all is possible. In this post-Christendom world, there is no unity of witness that would make clear to the world what abundance within limits looks like. Instead, Christian communities, large and small, here and there, in mostly modest ways, do the playful, joyful work of making this evident. They do it, say, in community gardens where on a limited plot of earth an abundance of riches comes forth, food and friendships, or in intentional communities where limited resources, blessed and shared, become more than enough for all. With humility, Christ's body speaks with words and actions that the world might know itself as the world. The limits we must live within, ecologically, economically, and otherwise, are the conditions in which we may have life and have it abundantly. And in this, we are able to affirm the truth of the priestly writer's refrain, "God saw that it was good." And now to close. Words are all we've got. If you've ever tried to change the behavior of a headstrong toddler or teenager with words, you know something of the futility of human speech. If you have longed for silence amid the ceaseless chatter of our days, then you may not be all that impressed by this talk of language. Can't we all just shut up already? To say that words are all we've got may not sound like very good news in the talkative times in which we live. Thankfully, we are being saved by a word who speaks in and through us, whose own life, death, and life beyond death reveal the God of creation, whose grace sustains us in our stumbling to articulate Christ in and for the world. And as we heard in the word read from Isaiah earlier today, we have God's promise that our efforts are not in vain. So shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose and succeed in the thing for which I sent it. This is the word of the Lord. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. As Brett mentioned, we're going to take about 10 minutes in your table groups to begin a conversation. Gives each of you an opportunity, we hope, to engage some of the things that Deborah has talked about. As a way of focusing our attention a little bit, I want to give you a couple of questions to consider your time. Then after about 10 minutes in table group, we'll come back and we'll share maybe some responses that you have to those questions and other things that you'd like to engage Deborah about that goes beyond the couple of questions here. Deborah mentioned more than once that we're called to be stewards. The church is called to be a steward of the gift of language. And she asked the question about, you know, how do we as creatures, you know, exercise that responsibility to care properly for the words we've been given to speak. So we have this notion that somehow we've been called to be stewards, to exercise responsibility about the words that have been entrusted to us. So here's sort of the two-part question for your table for the next 10 minutes. Given the context of your own congregational life where all of you are rooted, what are some of the real challenges and obstacles that you experience to being faithful stewards of language, of the church's language, where you are? Deborah mentioned some of the ones that culture throws up to us, but I suspect all of us are in slightly different places and you may have different obstacles. So that's the first question. If we consider ourselves stewards of language, called to exercise word care, what in your experience are some of the challenges and obstacles to being such? And secondly, sort of the flip side of that, I mean, what wisdom do you have from your own experience? What practices, examples can you give us that are sort of hopeful about sharing wisdom and stories, perhaps some suggestions or insights about what faithful word care might look like? Where have you seen that practiced in your own locations in ways that might enrich our own imaginations as we think about what word care might actually look like in concrete congregations? Is that clear enough? So the first one is, what are the obstacles to careful word care in congregations in your experience, and the other is, what wisdom or insights do you have about that? Take about 10 minutes to talk with each other about that, and then we'll reconvene as a plenary and share some of your wisdom and insight. Thank you. Let me call you back together. I guess you're not dead. We have about 20 minutes, and Xu Ming has a microphone on that side of the room, and I'll have a microphone on this side of the room. And you're not limited to the two questions that were sort of at the table group, but if you want to offer some wisdom from your table, or if you want to engage with Deborah specifically about an issue that she raised in her plenary address, then you're welcome to do that as well. But I'm sure we have a number of people who'd like to join the larger conversation here in the next 20 minutes, so if you can try to keep your question or your comment concise, that would be helpful. We'll try to get as many people involved as possible. So we'd like to
start us off with some wisdom or insight or question from your table.
Deborah, in response to Phil's first question, I said I think that one of the main problems with the language of creation is how it's not Trinitarian discipline in a way that underwrites the generalized presumption that something had to start it all. So creation turns out to be a stalking horse for deism. And so how you recover the appropriate practices that will let you use the language of creation seems to me to be one of the decisive challenges before us.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, as I said, we think it's a kind of cultural thing going on between, you know, creationists, evolutionists, this whole thing about how the world got started. But I think Christians, people in the pews, are just as uninformed and unformed by Trinitarian discourse about creation as anyone, so we don't even have the skill to be able to speak to that cultural conversation. I agree. I don't have an answer to that, but I agree. Yeah.
Deborah, we were talking about how to take care of words and being playful with them, but, you know, mainly about how to take care of words, and we discovered there was a sizable number of confusions about it, typically people in Texas, but we were remarking here, several professional authors, for example, didn't know the word stewardship and pledge, and it feels like there must be a toolbox of words that have gone unused, and I'm really asking for your comment. My father was an expert mechanic, and I remember how maddening it was that every time he used a flathead screwdriver to open a paint can, you know, they would just go insane because bad use of tools for the wrong purpose. And I wonder if you could comment about how to keep the play but still keep the words, or absolutely those rich words in play. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that gets to what I was saying about the received wisdom of the church is, it is a kind of enclosure of sorts, but it's a big room that we get to play in, and so how we kind of hold those two realities together, that there's room for experimenting, playing with language, but there are these parameters, there are these things we know we can't say. I think maybe that speaks to Stanley's earlier point, because we really suffer from a lack of real formation in churches where people have a deep understanding of these words and their lived reality as not just sort of propositions to assent to, but kind of doctrine to embody and inhabit. Because that's really where we're sort of, the poverty of our language comes through. We're at a real loss. I don't know what the solution is, other than to again affirm the observation that we're holding in tension this big space to play in, but there are things that there are limits to what we can and can't say, and how do we foster that and encourage that and train people better to be better at these sorts of linguistic exercises. Yeah, it's a challenge.
As someone who has listened to the screen roll down in the middle of our worship service for the last 3 years and covering up our picture of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, I appreciate your challenge for me to show up at my administrative council here in a couple of weeks and say, do we really want to keep doing this? But My question, the question I have with the group is hear a little more of your relationship with words and action. And I've got a blue-collar congregation, and when I talk about friendship, they want to see friendship. I think Wendell Berry said up to Duke a couple of years ago, he said, you may love your neighbor not for sentimental reasons. You may need to love your neighbor because you might need them one day. And the other issue I have with the words and actions, we just left Pensacola, business and family. And when this catastrophe got started, BP said they would pay every legitimate claim. Well, what they're finding is that a lot of the small fishermen down there operate on a cash basis. They catch their fish and sell them to the market. They don't have any W-2. So there's this entire community down there that has no legitimate claim, that has been harmed, I guess, financially worse than anybody, right, other than the hotel owners, who all have legitimate claims to their stuff. So my question, where does word and action, if you could just say a couple more words about that. Which one's ahead of the other, or do they both walk together, I guess is what I'm trying to get my head around.
Well, I think it's a peculiarly Protestant thing that we, as I said a moment ago, we like to give assent to particular terms or words. We're into the vocabulary, right? We believe in God. We want to give a kind of formal, mental, intellectual affirmation of these words that we've grown up hearing. But to actually embody them, to live them out, that's probably not what we're as good at. I guess I would always come back to worship. That's what we're doing in worship, is sort of acting out this story week to week. We're kind of rehearsing this narrative. But then the challenge is, I always think about this as a real catechetical challenge. You can't assume people know that that's what we're doing. They won't make that assumption. So you have to figure out, without necessarily always dragging out the chalkboard or being too didactic about it, how to communicate that what we say we believe is actually what we're doing every time we gather, and to hold together those two things, that worship itself is a sort of living into this language. It's an embodying of these words and themes and ideas, but then to help people process that as what we are actually doing. So just, one off the top of my head response would be, worship is a place to start with that, to help people see that when they come to church, they're not just sitting there to hear your words sort of come at them, but to embody this whole narrative that makes us who we are. So helping people get that, starting with worship.
Hi, Deborah. I'm a music pastor in San Francisco, and I was interested in particularly your comment about praise music and sort of contemporary praise music. Speaking from a place of somebody who tries to honestly write music that sort of hits all the beats of being something that people can sing, something that people can relate to, and something that's theologically valuable, and something that's rich. I was interested in, the Mighty Fortress is Our God is a beautiful, theologically rich song, and I'm, in my church we don't sing Our God is an Awesome God because I don't find it particularly in our setting, but I was interested in I wonder if you would say a few more words about contemporary worship and even more broadly contemporary art and how that applies, I guess, to sort of trying to communicate God and the gospel to are even, like, specifically our younger congregations. I'm coming from a congregation that's very young, and so I'd be interested to hear sort of some further comments about contemporary art, contemporary Christian expression, and how you would address that. Next.
Well, I think those categories we tend to sort of use: traditional, contemporary, blended. There are some newer words, are not all that helpful. And I'm sure the way I sort of couched those couple of paragraphs might have made it sound like a kind of blanket condemnation of everything contemporary and just you know, bring out the old hymnals and we're all good to go. But actually it's looking at the content, looking at the words themselves. So, of course, a song that might fall under the category of contemporary could meet all the right criteria, I think, of having that kind of depth, musical depth, linguistic depth. So it's not playing those categories off of each other, but paying more attention. I mean, I think maybe that's just it. Paying more attention to the words and sort of the meaning behind the words and what all is in there. It's paying attention.
Do we have anybody on the right side of the room? I guess this is the goats over here. Do the sheep have anything to ask? Xi Ming has a microphone over there if you want to.
I think you're right that context is everything, right?
Yeah.
In negotiating these matters, as I just said, there's not one blanket solution. It matters what's going on in your place. It matters that you have the right kind of relationships to even bring up the question. So, yeah, context is all.
Case to help him try to learn how to talk, his parents have had to say, for a long
mean, I think certainly we could all do a better job of seeing that all that we do in our congregational life together is kind of a piece. You know, we don't do worship and then have a potluck, and those are kind of, I mean, they are. They have some integrally separate sorts of ends to them, but in a way they are cultivating this common life and common language and ability to form the kind of relationships where we can begin to talk about the things that need to be talked about. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole spectrum of things we could see that constitute the congregational life that we probably, again, don't pay enough attention to. And play could certainly, I think, be one of those. I mean, churches have softball teams, I guess, but I mean, I'm not sure how that is ever sort of integrated into anything more meaningful than just, you know, beating the other guys or whatever. But, yeah. I don't know how to speak to your thing about our speechlessness with the Trinity. I guess other than to say, again, we've just, historically, it seems, in most congregations, not been shaped liturgically and catechetically in ways to be able to talk Trinitarianly, or to even see that what we're doing, again, as the body of Christ together, is a kind of expression of that mutuality. We're just not there, it seems.
I think this is the last question here. Check.
I like your use of the word playful. I'm a 32-year-old preschooler, and I really like that idea. I'm just, in my mind, I'm having a little trouble connecting how that works in a church. I like the metaphor, we're in a large room, lots of toys. I guess I'm just looking for maybe examples you've experienced or you've seen in churches of what that looks like. Because my mind goes to what was said about playing individually. I think about myself, how I construct a sermon, how I write music, how we put worship together. But how do you see that community? What are some practical examples you've experienced?
Before I took my current job, I, as Phil said, worked in a large, pretty affluent congregation in suburban Raleigh, North Carolina. And one of the things we did, and I mentioned this briefly at the end of the paper, not this church by name, but we started a community garden. I use that in the paper to talk about this notion of abundance within limits. But I can also say, in recalling that experience, again, it wasn't just something separate from the rest of what we did as a congregation, but it was integral to our whole life together. And it was physical and being outdoors, and it's work. Gardening is work. I think everybody sort of agrees that's the case. But it also had this sort of sense of play about it. Maybe not play in the strictest form of that word. So that would be one, that in this experience of being together every week outside, and again, trying, which is sort of my job, was to try to help us see without, again, being the didactic school teacher about it, but to say what we're doing here is not extraneous to who we are when we worship on Sunday. It's not something just for the people with green thumbs, but growing food and friendship and doing this activity in this way. I'm not sure I used the word playful then, but it strikes me that that's what it was, and we kind of made those connections. That's one example. There may be others that some of you talked about in your groups. I don't know, but Phil, are we done?
Well, the good thing is we still have 2 more days to talk about this together. And I know y'all want to join me in thanking Deborah for getting us up to this talk. Together for these 2 or 3 days is that the conversations we sort of start here and raise, we continue at table discussions around meals and on to the evenings. So really is just the beginning of a really helpful conversation. I think another very helpful issue to raise. So thank you, Denver, for getting us off to a good start. Thank you for your work at your tables and for jumping into the conversation as a whole.
As you can see, our catering staff